or comfort. Whether you are consciously meaning to do this or not, this is the effect tone policing has on people of color. There will always be people within movements that you do not like. There will always be actions that people within movements take that you will not agree with. And you certainly do not have to blindly follow a movement just because you believe in the cause. In fact, it's very important that you always keep your eyes open and stay true to your morals. But do not let your feelings about a person within the movement become the focus of your work toward fighting racial oppression. Even if you do not agree with the way in which someone is going about their fight for racial justice, recognize when they are indeed fighting for it and that you do have the same goals. When you instead shift your focus to getting people of color to fight oppression in a way in which you approve, racial justice is no longer your main goal. Your approval is. Find areas of the movement for equality with which you feel confident that the main goal is equality and within which you do not feel that you are violating your principles. Do work there. And where that work coincides with the work of others, join hands. Remember, this isn't about you. And it isn't about the person in the movement that you do not like. Work will be and constantly is done within movements to make them more effective. Critique already exists from within, rest assured. Movements grow and change. Do not think that there is a complaint against a member of the racial justice movement that you could lodge that is not already being debated. But know that if you are a privileged person trying to impose your wishes on social justice movements, you are trying to remake that movement in your image, which is exactly what social justice movements are fighting against. If you are a white person concerned with fighting racial oppression, and you want to avoid this sort of tone policing behavior and stay focused on being a true ally in the battle against racism, here are some things to remember. Be aware of the limits of your empathy. Your privilege will keep you from fully understanding the pain caused to people of color by systemic racism. But just because you cannot understand it, that does not make it any less real. Don't distract or deflect. The core issue in discussions of racism and systemic oppression will always be racism and systemic oppression. Remember your goal. Your main goal, if you consider yourself an ally, should always be to end systemic racism. Drop the prerequisites. That goal should not have any preconditions on it. You are fighting systemic racism because it is your moral obligation, and that obligation is yours as long as systemic racism exists. Pure and simple. Walk away if you must, but don't give up. If you simply cannot abide an oppressed person or group's language or methods, step aside and find where you can help elsewhere. Build a tolerance for discomfort. You must get used to being uncomfortable and get used to this not being about your feelings if you plan to help and not hinder people of color in their efforts for racial justice. You are not doing any favors. You are doing what is right. If you are white, remember that white supremacy is a system you benefit from and that your privilege has helped to uphold. Your efforts to dismantle white supremacy are expected of decent people who believe in justice. You are not owed gratitude or friendship from people of color for your efforts. We are not thanked for cleaning our own houses. If you are a person of color who is being shamed or criticized by privileged people for your tone, please remember this. You have a right to your anger, sadness, and fear. These are natural reactions to the unnatural system of racial oppression. You were born deserving equality and justice. Nobody should be able to take that away from you. Your humanity does not have to be earned. You matter. You are no less important than those who try to put preconditions on your humanity. Nobody has authority over your fight for racial justice. Those who tone police you are trying to manipulate you into thinking that their validation is required to legitimize your desire for racial justice. This is abusive behavior. You deserve to be able to speak your truth, and you deserve to be heard. Conversations about race and racial oppression can certainly be tough, but that's nothing compared to how tough fighting against racial oppression can be. Our humanity is worth a little discomfort. It's actually worth a lot of discomfort. But if you live in this system of white supremacy, you are either fighting the system or you are complicit. There is no neutrality to be had towards systems of injustice. It is not something you can just opt out of. If you believe in justice and equality, we are in this together, whether you like me or not. Chapter 16. I just got called racist. What do I do now? It was one of the most disgusting moments of my presidency, George W. Bush declared earnestly to Matt Lauer. 2 years after his presidency, during which he started two wars that cost hundreds of thousands of lives and destabilized an entire region of the world, the former president was talking about the moments that had stood out to him. And there, in his list of the most disgusting moments, was the time that Kanye West said that George W. Bush doesn't care about black people. In his book Decision Points, Bush talks further about how hurt he was by Kanye's accusation. It was, in his words, an all-time low of his presidency. I faced a lot of criticism as president. I didn't like hearing people claim that I lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction or cut taxes to benefit the rich. But the suggestion that I was racist because of the response to Katrina represented an all-time low. I remember at the time feeling shocked and a little amused by this. After all the atrocities that George W. Bush saw in his presidency, terror attacks, unjust wars resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths, the largest recession since the Great Depression, and so much more. Having someone insinuate that he was racist was the all-time low. How out of touch. How self-centered. I remember thinking that it was yet another sign that the former president was a weird emotional child who was not at all qualified for the presidency. This was, of course, before Donald Trump showed us all what weird emotional child not at all qualified for the presidency really looks like. But I thought of this mostly as a funny aberration. That was, of course, until I started writing about race. If you write about race or talk about race, you will quickly realize that GWB's reaction to the insinuation of racism is disturbingly common. To many white people, it appears, there is absolutely nothing worse than being called a racist. Or someone insinuating you might be racist, or someone saying that something you did was racist, or somebody calling somebody you identify with racist. Basically, anytime the label of racist touches you at all, it's the worst thing to happen to anybody anywhere. I remember once after sharing an article on Twitter about racism in the U.S., when a white Canadian tweeted back, "You should move to Canada. We aren't racist here." I pointed out that according to recent news of the reluctance of government officials to fully investigate the murders of dozens of Indigenous women, the controversy over carding of black Canadians by police, and the testimony of my Canadian friends of color, Canada was plenty racist. This white Canadian stranger kept insisting that no, there was no racism in Canada because he had not seen it. When some of my Canadian friends chimed in with helpful links about high-profile incidences of racism and investigations into systemic racism in Canada, the white Canadian continued to insist that they were wrong and that racism doesn't exist in Canada. I pointed out the irony of stating that racism doesn't exist while talking over, belittling, and denying the lived experiences of Canadians of color. His response was quick. "Are you calling me racist? You cunt." Mr. Friendly White Canadian then proceeded to harass me on social media for weeks until his account was suspended. For hours each day, he sought out anyone who commented on one of my tweets, informing them that I was a reverse racist who hated white people and loved calling innocent people racists. After I blocked him on Twitter, he would log on from other accounts he created just to continue the harassment. He did not appear to be, from his internet history, a professional troll or serial harasser. Something about my insinuation that his actions may be racist had triggered a deep rage inside of him, and he was going to make me pay. This is perhaps a slightly more extreme example of the racial confrontation formula. A white person does something racially insensitive and harmful. It is pointed out to them, and they go nuclear. People have tried to get me fired from gigs, have tried to organize protests of my public events, have sent me threatening emails, all for pointing out how their actions are hurting others. And I'm not alone. When I asked a group of people of color what they feared most when talking about racism, their number one concern was retaliation. One friend knows of at least two websites dedicated to smearing her because she called a white woman's language racist. One friend was fired from a job after a Facebook argument in which she said an associate was acting racist. One friend was subject to a months-long campaign to turn her community against her after stating that someone's actions were insensitive to people of color. Countless friends have had emails sent to their employers and educators by white people incensed that someone would insinuate that their actions are racist. Even when the words racist or racism are never said, even the slightest implication can shift the entire conversation from, "Hey, this hurts people of color," to, "Did you just call me racist? I am not racist. I am a good person. How dare you?" It's not as if it's easy for people of color to call out racism. When we decide to talk about these things, not only are we having to confront our own feelings of hurt, disappointment, or anger, we know that we are also risking any of the above reactions and more. When we decide to talk about racism, we know that it could indeed end our friendships, our reputations, our careers, and even our lives. The response to our complaints of racism or racial insensitivity are not always met with such violent reactions, but no matter what, it is never a pleasant conversation for people of color to have. I do not know a single person of color who does not broach these conversations with a very heavy heart, and they almost always leave with one even heavier. So why do we talk about racism if it's so risky and so painful? Because we have no choice. Because not talking about it is killing us. Because for far too long, the burden of racism has always been on us alone. If you are white and you are reading this, and wondering why we bother if these conversations are as bad as I say, think of how bad the alternative, continued, unchecked racism, would have to be in order to get you to risk that much, and you'll know a little more about the reality of life for people of color. This chapter is for white people. Of course, non-white people will read it as well, and I hope that it is informative to most and perhaps validating to others. But I am aiming this chapter at you, the white person who is afraid of being called racist, who may well be avoiding further investing in the fight for racial justice because you know that one wrong move may have you labeled as a white supremacist. If you see even a little bit of yourself in this, you need to keep reading. If you are convinced that you are past all of that, you should probably still keep reading, because these defensive impulses run deep and may take you by surprise, just when you thought you had gotten past all of your discomfort around race. Who are you? You are, at times, kind and mean, generous and selfish, witty and dull. Sometimes you are all of these things at once, and if you are white in a white supremacist society, you are racist. If you are male in a patriarchy, you are sexist. If you are able-bodied, you are ableist. If you are anything above poverty in a capitalist society, you are classist. You can sometimes be all of these things at once. You do, as Walt Whitman said, contain multitudes. I know that the above is all that some people need to chuck this book out a window. Typical, some might say. Another social justice warrior who thinks all white people are racist. But you've come this far and already invested so much in this process. Please, consider sitting with your discomfort for a while longer and see where this chapter takes you. We like to think of our character in the same way it is written in our obituaries. We are strong, brave, and loyal. We are funny and creative. We are what we strive to be. While if we sit and reflect, we can provide a more nuanced description of ourselves. In our day-to-day lives, our self-esteem reads in synopsis, Mary was a kind and loving mother, an avid gardener. But life is a series of moments, and in reality, we are both the culmination of those countless moments and each moment individually in time. Say you get drunk in a bar and punch a stranger in the face, spend the night in jail, realize that your life has taken a turn for the worse, get treatment, stop drinking, and dedicate your life to anti-violence work. To the person that you punched that night, you may forever be the person who assaulted them, the person who made them scared to go into bars for a while, the person who made them feel violated. To the people you have helped since, you may always be a hero, the person who made them safer in the world. These are both who you are. They are both valid and do not cancel each other out. If you run into the person you punched years later, they may well still be afraid of you. They may react with anger. They will treat you like someone who punched them, because you are. And even if you respond to that anger and fear like someone who abhors violence, because that is also who you are, you have no right to demand that they see you differently. Why all of this talk about the ways in which we can all be both an abuser and a healer? Because you have been a racist, and you have been anti-racist. Yes, you may now be insisting that you do not have a racist bone in your body. But that is simply not true. You have been racist and will be in the future, even if less so. You are racist because you were born and bred in a racist white supremacist society. White supremacy is, as I've said earlier, insidious by design. The racism required to uphold white supremacy is woven into every area of our lives. There is no way you can inherit white privilege from birth, learn racist white supremacist history in schools, consume racist and white supremacist movies and films, work in a racist and white supremacist workforce, and vote for racist and white supremacist governments, and not be racist. This does not mean that you have hate in your heart. You may intend to treat everyone equally, but it does mean that you have absorbed some fucked up shit regarding race, and it will show itself in some fucked up ways. You may not know why you clutch your purse a little harder when a black man walks by you, but in the moment you do, you are being racist. You may not know why when you see a bad driver on the road and you recognize they are Asian, a little voice inside you goes, aha! But in that moment, you are being racist. You may not know why you are pleasantly surprised that the Latinx person you are talking to is so articulate. But in that moment, you are being racist. And that racism informs a lot of your decisions in ways that you are not aware. It informs how you vote, where you spend your money, whom you hire, what books you read, whom you socialize with, what social concerns you will pay attention to. And that racism does real harm to real people, both immediately and systematically. To the person you harmed in that racist moment, you may forever be the person who harmed them, because you did. You may also be other things to them. You may also be a friend, a co-worker, or a neighbor. And you can decide that you don't ever want to be a racist to anyone else. And you can work toward that goal. But you cannot tell someone to deny the harm you've done to them. And that sucks. It sucks to know that to some people you will forever be the person who harmed them. It sucks to know that someone you have harmed in the past may one day read in your obituary, John was a generous and loyal friend to all he met, and disagree. You've tried so hard to be a good person, but your intentions cannot erase the harm that your actions cause. This is real harm that has been done. And you have to accept that if you do not want to continue harming people by denying their lived experiences and denying your responsibility, this does not mean that you have to flog yourself for all eternity. The pain you've caused is real, and if you have a conscience, the recognition of that will likely sting a little whenever you think about it. But everything else you've done, all of the effort you've made to be a better person, that is just as valid and deserves equal billing in your obit. Your mistakes or your achievements will never on their own define you, but you can only do better if you are willing to look at your entire self. All of this is to say that if you have been called racist or something you have done has been called racist by a person of color, you cannot simply dismiss it outright. Even if that accusation is in direct opposition to all that you try to be, not if you are truly committed to racial justice. Now is an opportunity to learn more about yourself, to see yourself and your actions more clearly so you can move toward the person you truly want to be. The question is, do you want to look like a better person, or do you want to be a better person? Because those who just want to look like a better person will have great difficulty with the introspection necessary to actually be a better person. In order to do better, we must be willing to hold our darkness to the light. We must be willing to shatter our own veneer of goodness. So if you've been confronted with the possibility of your own racism and you want to do the work, here are some tips. Listen. First and foremost, if someone is telling you something about yourself and your actions, and you feel your hackles raising, take that as a sign that you need to stop and listen. If your blood pressure rose too quickly to really hear what was being said, take a few deep breaths, ask the person to repeat themselves if necessary, and listen again. Don't add to what the person is saying. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't immediately think, oh, you think I'm a monster now. Just try to actually hear what they are trying to communicate to you. Set your intentions aside. Your intentions have little to no impact on the way in which your actions may have harmed others. Do not try to absolve yourself of responsibility with your good intentions. Try to hear the impact of what you have done. Don't just hear the action. You consistently speak over me in work meetings, and you do not do that to white people in our meetings. That is easy to brush off as, I just didn't agree with you, or I didn't mean to, I was just excited about a point I was trying to make. Don't make a big deal out of nothing. Try to also hear the impact. Your bias is invalidating my professional expertise and making me feel singled out and unappreciated in a way which compounds all of the many ways I'm made to feel this way as a woman of color in the workplace. Remember that you do not have all of the pieces. You are not living as a person of color. You will never fully understand the impact that sustained systemic racism has on people of color. You will never be able to fully empathize with the pain your actions may have caused. Nothing will get you there. Do not discount someone's complaint because their emotions seem foreign to you. You may think that someone is making a mountain out of a molehill, but when it comes to race, actual mountains are indeed made of countless molehills stacked on top of each other. Each one adds to the enormity of the problem of racism. Nobody owes you a debate. It is very hard on people of color to call out racism. Sometimes that is the most they can do. And while you may really want to get it all sorted out right then and there, understand that when you ask to talk it out, you are asking for more emotional labor from somebody who is already hurt. It is nice if you get it, and you should be grateful, but it is not owed you. You can still give this serious thought. You can still look deep inside yourself. You can still Google for more insight. Remember, it's highly unlikely that anything you've done has not been done before. Even if the person who brought this to your attention does not want to engage further. Nobody owes you a relationship. Even if you've recognized where you've been racist, worked to make amends, and learned from your mistakes, the person that you harmed does not owe you a relationship of any kind. In a hostile world, people of color have the right to cut off contact with people who have harmed them. They do not have to stick around to see all the progress you've made. Remember that you are not the only one hurt. Yes, it hurts to know that somebody thinks you are being racist, but you are not the first one hurt here. It is the deep hurt of racism that forced this person to confront you. Do not make this about your pain at being called out. If you can see where you have been racist, or if you can see where your actions have caused harm, apologize and mean it. Think about how you can make amends, if possible, and how you can avoid those same harmful actions in the future. If you cannot see where you have been racist, take some more time to seriously consider the issue some more before declaring your actions not racist. There have been conversations I've had about race with white people that ended in absolute denials, only to have that white person come back to me months later to say that they finally realized that their actions were racist, and they were sorry for the harm they had caused, not only by their actions, but by their vigorous denial of my experiences. If, after a lot of careful thought, you still do not see your actions as racist, and feel strongly that this is simply a misunderstanding, do not then invalidate that person's hurt. A true misunderstanding isn't so just because your intentions were not racist. A true misunderstanding is when your actions do not actually have a racist impact, even though somebody thinks they might. If I hit you but do not intend to hit you, that is not a misunderstanding about whether or not I hit you. The situation you are in may be a misunderstanding. It does happen, even if it happens less often than you think. But even if it is, the pain of the person confronting you is real. Do not deny that. Do not call it silly. Explain your viewpoint if you feel it's necessary. And hope that explanation sheds light that helps that person see the situation the same way that you do. But don't deny someone's lived experience. Your goal is to find out if you are being racist, not to prove that you aren't, and to resolve a painful situation if possible. This is not an easy process, and it is not at all fun. And at times it seems never-ending. At times it may seem like no matter what you do, you are doing something wrong. But you have to try to adjust to the feelings of shame and pain that come from being confronted with your own racism. You have to get over the fear of facing the worst in yourself. You should instead fear unexamined racism. Fear the thought that right now you could be contributing to the oppression of others and you don't know it. But do not fear those who bring that oppression to light. Do not fear the opportunity to do better. Chapter 17. Talking is great, but what else can I do? I'm sure if we could just talk about it, you'd have me all straightened out. This was the stubborn insistence from a theater director who had just finished loudly repeating "nigger" to a group of people of color at what had at first been a wonderful dinner discussing an upcoming art project and how we could ensure that it would be inclusive. A lot of painstaking effort had gone into making sure that the people of color, many queer and trans, felt safe in this environment. It is very hard as a person of color to feel comfortable in Seattle, especially in the upper echelons of the local art scene. But we were bringing a different show to this theater, one that focused on voices of color and hoped to bring in a community of color. So we had gathered for dinner to talk about how we could accomplish this. Everything had been going well until one of the theater directors, a white man, decided after what was likely a few too many drinks to tell a story that he felt required him to say "nigger" loudly and repeatedly, without warning. Each time he said it, people of color at the table flinched as the word hit. It wasn't just the word "nigger," we've all heard it. It was the fact that it had come after we'd let our guard down, after so much effort to let us know we were safe. The dinner ended very quickly after that. Once it was over, the head of the group that was going to be performing let the director know that what had just gone down was unacceptable and that they would not feel comfortable performing unless the staff of the theater underwent racial justice and awareness training to ensure that this would not happen again. The director looked at me pleadingly. He didn't need training. He knew a lot of black people. He grew up with black people. He was practically black himself. He just needed to talk with me. He repeatedly insisted that if I could just sit with him in a bar and talk this out with him, whatever had caused him to drunkenly repeat "nigger" at a dinner table surrounded by people of color would never happen again. But I did not want to talk with this man, especially not over drinks. I had just been talking with this man, we all had. We had just spent hours talking about racial and social justice, and he still decided to say "nigger." I wanted this man to take some action for change. If you want to talk about race, there is plenty of opportunity. There are countless memes you post, tons of outrage you can share, limitless thought exercises you can participate in. But it is easy to get caught up in this talk and think you are doing so much more than just that. Talk. While many people are afraid to talk about race, just as many use talk to hide from what they really fear, action. The more that I write about race, the more I've been surrounded by this talk disguised as action. From the white men using my Facebook and Twitter feeds as their own virtue-signaling playground, to the white women sending me 5-paragraph-long emails letting me know how the racial oppression of people of color makes them feel personally, I've seen how addicted people can get to the satisfaction of knowing they are saying all the right things, that they are having deep conversations. So addicted that it becomes the end-all and be-all of their racial justice goals. I write about concepts that I think people are not understanding. I write about pieces of the puzzle that I think people aren't seeing. I write from perspectives that I think many people don't get to hear. I do not do this just to increase general knowledge. I do not do this just to make people feel better. I do this in the hopes that what I write and say, and what others write and say, will inform and inspire action. But so often, that is missed. Recently, I was explaining online and on a local radio station why I will not be participating in a local protest march focusing on women's issues. I had been asked to speak and told how very important it was that the event have speakers who were women of color, especially in a predominantly white area like Seattle. I asked what the commission for speaking was and was told that speakers were expected to donate their time and services. I declined the invitation. When I wrote about why I would not be participating in the march, I explained that I could not ignore how much the economic exploitation of women of color had contributed to the racial oppression of women of color, and I did not believe that women of color should be asked to put forth the emotional and mental labor of discussing their racial oppression to a majority white audience for free, especially an event with a large budget like this one. I was very careful in my explanation of why I felt that this ask was problematic, and how important it is for us to not further exploitation and oppression within our movements. It wasn't long before I got a message in response from a white woman I didn't know. She understood that I didn't want to work for free, but she didn't understand how asking for that work had been exploitative. Could I please take the time to explain to her further, personally, and I'm assuming for free, so she could understand? She is not alone. Countless people read my work about racial justice, and instead of taking action, want to shake that Etch-a-Sketch like it never happened and ask for the same conversation all over again. I've lost count of the times I've had to end a conversation with someone about race because instead of listening and engaging, they were trying to deny my experiences as a woman of color and bully me into agreeing with them, only to have them reach out later that day to ask me to join them for coffee in order to talk some more about the subject. After a few times of agreeing to talk some more, and once again finding myself talked over, I realized that talk was all they wanted to get out of it. At least once a week, an organization will ask me to come talk, free of charge, to them about race. They are big fans of my work and just want to be able to have their own private conversations with me. We would like a safe space to really get educated, one said. These are people who have read my work, had likely stopped by on social media to like posts and leave encouraging comments. These are people who have read my words on the mental, physical, and financial exploitation of black people, and especially black women, and the way in which it contributes to oppression. They have read the pain in my stories, and it resonated with them enough that they wanted me to repeat it all on demand for free. This is talk that will make them sad, make them frustrated, make them cry. But it won't make them take action. They want to feel better, but they don't want to do better. Words matter, and I'm not just saying that because they are my job. Words help us interpret our world and can be used to change the way in which we think and act. Words are always at the heart of all our problems and the beginning of all our solutions. We cannot understand race and racial oppression if we cannot talk about it, and we can never stop the racial oppression affecting millions of lives in this country if we do not understand how and why it has been able to hold such power over us for hundreds of years. But understanding on its own will never equal action. There are a lot of complex issues out there that many of us have talked about and understand fairly well. Take, for example, global warming. The vast majority of Americans believe in global warming and understand that it is likely brought on by pollution. And while we talk about global warming and worry about global warming, most of us go about our days the same as we did before we ever heard the term, because it's just easier to talk than to do. And global warming continues. Until we have dismantled the system of white supremacy and racial oppression, we will always need to talk about it. And I hope that you will use what you've read in this book to talk about it more successfully. And I hope that as you continue to have these conversations about race, you will see opportunities for action and use what you've learned from your conversations to make that action more effective at dismantling oppression. Talk. Please talk and talk and talk some more. But also act. Act now. Because people are dying now in this unjust system. How many lives have been ground up by racial prejudice and hate? How many opportunities have we already lost? Act and talk and learn and fuck up and learn some more and act again and do better. We have to do this all at once. We have to learn and fight at the same time, because people have been waiting far too long for their chance to live as equals in this society. It is easy to think that the problem of racial oppression in this country is just too big. How on earth can we be expected to dismantle a complex system that has been functioning for over 400 years? My answer is piece by piece. If you are looking for some small steps you can take right now to help create real change in the fight against racial oppression, if you are looking for your little piece of the system you can dismantle, here are some ideas. Vote local. Your vote will never have more power than in local elections. This is where politicians and city and state officials have to work for your vote. And so often, this opportunity to flex local power is flushed away by those who only vote in big, sexy, national elections. Vote local and demand that anybody asking for your vote, from school board to city council to state senator, make racial justice a top priority. Get in schools. Do you know what the racial achievement gap is in your school district? Find out, and then ask your school board, principals, and teachers what they are doing to address it. Are your schools erasing the history and accomplishments of people of color from your child's textbooks? Are your children only learning about people of color in February? Let them know that an inclusive education that meets the needs of all students is a top priority for you, even if your child is not a child of color. Bear witness. If you are a white person and you see a person of color being stopped by police, if you see a person of color being harassed in a store, bear witness and offer to help when it is safe to do so. Sometimes just the watchful presence of another white person will make others stop and consider their actions more carefully. Speak up in your unions. I've watched with pride these last few years as my mother has leveraged her privilege at her union to help make her workplace more inclusive. A longtime union representative, my mom has not let a single meeting go by without asking about the union's goals to promote diversity and inclusivity. When her union wrote racial justice goals into their platform for the year, she called me beaming with pride. Unions have a lot of power to combat racial discrimination and disenfranchisement at work, but only if the union decides to make it a priority. Support POC-owned business. Economic exploitation is one of the cornerstones of racial oppression. You can help preserve financial independence for people of color by working with and spending your money with POC businesses. Boycott banks that prey on people of color. The recent housing crash brought many of the racist practices of some of our biggest banks to light. But banks have been exploiting and abusing people of color for hundreds of years. Banks that sell bad loans to people of color should not get your business. Banks that hike up interest rates for people of color should not get your business. Banks that discriminate against people of color should not get your business. If you make these despicable actions by banks too costly, they will stop doing them, but not before then. Give money to organizations working to fight racial oppression and support communities of color. There are groups out there fighting every day for people of color. They are running after-school programs, giving legal advice, providing job training, providing medical services, fighting school discrimination, and so much more. And this all costs money. Give what you can to groups like the ACLU, SPLC, Planned Parenthood, NAACP, National Immigrant Justice Center, National Council of La Raza, Native American Rights Fund, Native American Disability Law Center, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, and more. Reach out to people in your local community to see what local organizations could use your financial support. Boycott businesses that exploit workers of color. Many businesses rely on cheap labor from people of color working in unhealthy conditions. Boycott businesses that cut costs by cutting out respect and living wages for workers of color. Support music, film, television, art, and books created by people of color. So much of our cultural representation is white by default. Normalize the work of people of color by financially supporting it and asking your producers, museum owners, studios, radio stations, and publishers for more. Support increases in the minimum wage. Yes, there are many reasons why so many people of color are so much poorer than white people. But we cannot ignore the fact that a larger proportion of people of color work in lower wage jobs, and that a raise in those wages will disproportionately help people of color and can help address the vast racial wealth gap in this country. Push your mayor and city council for police reform. It is almost guaranteed that whatever city or town you live in, its police force can better serve its population of color. Ask your mayor what he or she is doing to address racial bias in policing. What training are officers undergoing? Do your officers have body cams? What sort of civilian oversight is there when there has been a complaint of bias, discrimination, or abuse? Put pressure on your city government to make this a priority and keep that pressure up. Otherwise, police unions will bully city government into supporting the status quo, even if it risks the lives of black and brown people in your neighborhood. Demand college diversity. If you are in college, getting ready for college, or have a kid going to college, let your college know that the diversity and inclusiveness of students, curriculum, and staff is a top priority for you. Make sure colleges know that you expect any quality higher education institution to embrace and promote diversity if they expect your tuition money. Vote for diverse government representatives. Help put people of color into the positions of power where they can self-advocate for the change that their communities need. Support candidates of color and support platforms that make diversity, inclusion, and racial justice a priority. I know that the issue of racism and racial oppression seems huge, and it is huge. But it is not insurmountable. When we look at it in its entirety, it seems like too much. But understand that the system is invested in you seeing it that way. The truth is, we all pull levers of this white supremacist system every day. The way we vote, where we spend our money, what we do and do not call out. These are all pieces of the system. We cannot talk our way out of a racially oppressive system. We can talk our way into understanding, and we can then use that understanding to act. I'll never forget the outrage in 2016 over a district prosecutor who refused to press charges against a cop who was filmed shooting an unarmed black man. People were tweeting their anger at the prosecutor, sharing Facebook posts about how frustrated they were that once again, a cop was going to get away with murder. But when I looked up information for the district attorney, I realized that he was up for re-election later that year. I immediately started replying to the tweets and messages of frustration that I was seeing. This person is running for re-election. Give your money to his challenger. Make an example of him. Because I already knew that if moral arguments and outrage were going to persuade a district attorney to press charges against an officer for shooting an unarmed black person, we would have seen more than only 18 officers charged with unlawful death in 2015 in over 1,100 killings of civilians by police that year. But everyone responds to threats to their livelihood, and declining to indict an officer when there is video proof of severe misconduct should be a decision that a prosecuting attorney cannot afford to make. We saw that action take hold in the March 2015 re-election bid of Cook County's state attorney Anita Alvarez, who after numerous high-profile police brutality cases where Alvarez was seen as less than responsive, including what many view to be a cover-up, and 13-month delay in pressing charges in the horrific shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, who was shot 16 times as he walked away from officers, was handed a resounding defeat to challenger Kim Fox. This defeat was the result not only of numerous protests in and around Chicago, but of organized efforts of Chicago activists to support Alvarez's challenger and get out the vote on election day. Not only was a prosecutor that many felt was a defender of police brutality and corruption removed from office, but a warning message was sent to prosecutors around the country. You cannot afford to protect a corrupt and violent police system. You don't always win the fight at first, but small actions add up, especially when you don't give up. In my hometown of Seattle in 2016, activists were engaged in a fight with the city over plans to build the most expensive new police precinct in the country. In a city with a housing crisis leading to rising homelessness, school funding so poor that the state Supreme Court has declared that it is in violation of the state constitution, and a rising opioid addiction problem, many balked at the thought of spending $160 million on a new police building. Add to that the fact that the Seattle Police Department was found by the federal government in 2011 to be practicing widespread abuse against its citizens and put under consent decree to reform its practices. And the fact that the consent decree process still had not been completed as of 2016. Many felt that our cops who had been dragging their feet at reform did not deserve a shiny new building with taxpayer dollars. Yes, we talked about it on social media, spreading the word about why the prevention of this new department headquarters, nicknamed the Bunker, was important. But we also took action. City council meetings were filled with concerned citizens waiting hours for the public comment period to voice their shock that the city would be taking money that could go to so many in need and giving it to a police system already found to be broken and failing in their promises of reform. At first, it was defeat after defeat. I remember taking my sons with me to a city council meeting where there were so many block the bunker people that we were moved into an overflow room. We watched people get up to speak, 60 seconds each, for over 2 hours, only to have the city council vote 11-1 to move forward with the project. My 9-year-old held his Black Lives Matter sign and asked, "Why aren't they listening to us?" But we didn't give up. The bunker was brought up at every public event the mayor or members of the city council attended. Every city council meeting, members of the council had to stare at an ocean of Seattleites wearing Block the Bunker t-shirts and holding Black Lives Matter signs. When the mayor voiced his intention to attend a highly popular community block party, he was informed by organizers that he could come, but they wanted him to know that they did not approve of his support of the new police headquarters. People wrote to our local newspapers and television stations asking them to increase their coverage of the Block the Bunker movement. Eventually, the tide began to change. Our major local papers, usually the voice of the status quo, came out against the new headquarters. More city council members voiced their concern. Finally, after almost a year of protest, the mayor announced that he was shelving the $160 million project. Then activists, partnered with Seattle City Council member Kashama Sawant, were able to get the city to commit a large portion of those funds to low-income housing. It was one of the highlights of my year, to be able to tell my kids that they had helped bring positive change to our city, that we can accomplish just about anything if we don't give up. All around the country, people are affecting real change with small actions. Change that improves the lives of people of color in their towns and cities and weakens an oppressive system. Racial oppression starts in our homes, our offices, our cities, and our states, and it can end there as well. So start talking. Not just problems, but solutions. We can do this together. This concludes the reading of So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Oluo. Copyright 2018 by Ijeoma Oluo. This book was read by Bonnie Turpin. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Distel, Goderich, and Burrett, LLC, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.